Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I've got filmmaker Rob Campoy with me. Hey, Rob.
How are you?
I'm good. Good. All right. So we just finished. Wow, a nice long chat. Nice long chat. So honestly, that's the reason I do this podcast anyway, right? Is just to get to know people and talk to them. Conversations about film and filmmaking. They're so much fun.
Sort of my favorite in the world.
Right? I mean, obviously, why else would I program a film festival?
I really hope at this point you enjoy it.
For sure. But this podcast, although I am about to say something about Rob's film, but this podcast is going to be Rob answering the Discover Indie Film 4 questions, which are favorite films of all time, an underrated film, an overrated film, and a lesser-known film that people should seek out. But before he answers those questions, I am going to bring up A Face on the Ceiling, Rob's film that won an award at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. It won Outstanding Short Film Horror. Outstanding film. We'll joke that my stepdaughter referred to it as Pretty Spiff. Wins the Pretty Spiff Award. Great film, and you can watch it as part of the Discover Indie Film TV series. So yeah, go to Amazon Prime Video, type in the words Discover Indie Film in the search, and enjoy a TV series that is short films handpicked from the festival circuit. They're all good. They're all self-financed. They're all made by people who really give a shit. They care enough to put their own resources on the line. So it's kind of the opposite of everything else you see on streaming, I gotta say. Because, you know, Hollywood movies can be great. But when you're watching a passion project, I think you know it. So that's my pitch. Everyone should go watch Rob's film in Discover Indie Film and all the other films. 6 seasons already by September 2022, I think is the year. All right, now I'm going to shut the fuck up. We haven't cursed too much, but we're allowed to curse here.
This is the most tepid I've been throughout the entirety of my life.
That's funny. So put a microphone in front of Rob Campoy and he's not going to curse.
Yeah, but the second it's gone, I'm a sailor.
Okay. Motherfucker. Oh, all right.
Fucking hell, man.
Fuck. Okay, so... You want to name your top? I think you're going to go over 3. There's no.
Yeah,
I always joke. There's impossible. No. There's no one in a black and white striped shirt with a whistle to stop you. So feel free. Favorite films.
Favorite of the most. I mean, you know what I mean. Like favorite that come to mind. Well, I guess I'll start with one that's not just coming to mind. One of the favorites throughout my entire life. I saw it when I was a kid. Is definitely Network. Patty Chayefsky, I think, wrote. I mean, it's what so many people say. I agree with that. Patty Chayefsky wrote one of the greatest screenplays of all time. It's one of the worst satiric nightmares, you know, in the best way. The fact that you're just going deeper and deeper into the hell that is the 24-hour news cycle, the hell that is the entertainment industry. You know, it's brilliant. You know, that in the end, when they're like, "Are we gonna kill him? Who's down for killing him?" You know what I mean? It's like, come on. It's great.
A brilliant classic 70s film and a prescient film, too.
Oh, yeah.
For what happened to news after that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I watch it at least once a year. Tess and I watched it recently, and we were just like, how the fuck was this made? How was this not made yesterday? This is, and I know that's, you know, that kind of phraseology is thrown around ad nauseum, but I truly feel that about Network in particular.
For sure, for sure. Okay, you got more.
Well, okay, so Network, made by Sidney Lumet, probably my favorite director. Stalker is one of my favorite films of all time. And the fact that they nearly died making it, you know what I mean? That they were shooting in Estonia, I want to say. But Andrei Tarkovsky is probably my second favorite director. I mean, it lists, again, Sisyphean, but trying to make them. But Tarkovsky's definitely up there. And so, you know, this film is a film that I have been obsessed with since childhood. And still rewatch it all the time. It's another sort of weird, nightmarish thing. This would be maybe more of a dream sometimes, but it's like, you know, the most esoteric tone poem of a film you could ever see. And I think what Tarkovsky does best, Or I mean, he does so many things great. But one of my takeaways from his films is texture. You know, the way he shoots anything, let it be, let alone a lake or just like the framing and what's in, you know, in the lake, or and that's sort of what may have killed him and some people on the crew. Is that they were shooting, you know, downriver from a disused facility. I forget what it was that, you know, had poisoned the water, basically. And so that's in the film, you know, some of that sort of disgusting texture in these, you know, places that they're shooting. And, you know, they shot for, like, how long before the film was exposed improperly? They shot for like months or a year or something and then had to go back and shoot again. And I just think Tarkovsky was a fascinating character. And I think that movie, I think we're all, you know, it inherently obsessed with a good mystery, you know? And I think that film depicts that, you know, what is the zone? What does it mean? How do we, you know, in the first act, how do we get in there? And it, just every aspect of it. And once you, you know, this is true to me across the board. Once you show me the thing, I'm no longer interested 9 times out of 10. But at the build up to the thing, you know, much love and respect to my prosthetic friends and my VFX friends and brilliant stuff is made. But the what we can create in our own heads is always far worse than, and I mean, in the case with Stalker, it's not necessarily a creature, but it's a place. So that aspect is sort of weird and magical to me.
That is a definite lesson of cinema, is the things that you picture in your head that were never even on screen are,
oh man,
so impactful.
Yeah. Completely. Yeah.
And it's something that has been lost in this digital era, maybe, where it is about showing things that can never be shown before. I mean,
yeah, I agree. I mean, with Lolita, Kubrick at the time couldn't put everything he wanted to into that, everything from the Nabokov novel. And you know, it's sort of like what people create in their head is sort of worse. I think that film might have been behooved by that, because we're all horrified by what's going on, and to not show it might have actually been more impactful. And I think that's true with so many films, where it's like, don't show me the thing until like the last minute. Or if then. I forget, I saw an interview with someone the other day when they were saying like the Blair Witch Project is brilliant. And Tess and I actually rewatched that recently as well, and I hadn't seen it since I was younger, and nothing happens, but it's the scariest movie ever. It's brilliant. You know what I mean? And I'm not a big horror guy, but I think it's brilliant just on like a human level. Like, you're constantly on edge and afraid and like a little, you know, sort of depressed and uneasy. It's like, it does all those sort of things that we like to subject ourselves to. You know what I mean?
You're making me think of other examples, but it's more important to hear the rest of your list. So I will continue to shut the fuck up and let you say your third.
Always down for more examples. Once again, Near Impossible. Battle of Algiers is definitely something I watch a lot. I like, you know, I saw that when I was young as well. I films that should be on a list should somewhat stand the test of your time in your life, you know. I think some of them at least on your list. So like, most of these are films that affected me when I was younger and still mean something today. And Battle of Algiers is one that, you know, is like a very serious, you know, political war film, you know, that was like banned in, it was banned in France for like 5 years. But a beautiful, beautiful, dirty film. And so that made me want to make like serious movies. You know what I mean? It made me want to like make mature movies that were serious. I mean, it's like a rowdy movie. You know, it's not like people in a room's talking. It's definitely not that, but it still felt like mature and adult as a kid. And I was like, I want to make serious movies like that one day.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like that golden era of Hollywood of films where the studio system had just sort of crashed at the end of the 60s and for like the first half of the 70s before, honestly, before Star Wars and Jaws fucked it all up. But like,
it's true.
People were just experimenting. Experimentation became the standard almost for major motion pictures.
100%, man. I mean, I'm one of those.
And your list people. Is like drawing heavily on that era, I think.
It's my favorite era. I mean, All the President's Men is definitely up there. One of my favorite movies. Alan J. Pakula, he was great. But so I'm definitely one of those people who thinks that the 70s was one of, if not the best era, because of the freedom to experiment. You know what I mean? And it was, no one knew what the fuck a weekend box office was from what I've read and been told. I mean, I wasn't alive, but no one knew, no one cared. It was like, you know, people were seeing weird shit. People wanted to see weird shit. You know what I mean? It was like such an odd experimental time. I saw a video last night. I forget who posted it, but it was people leaving the theater after Eraserhead when it was first released. And the I think in the what, I forget what year, but in the 70s, and people were like very mixed in there and very vociferous about it. But yeah, I agree completely that the 70s was such a fascinating time. I think Kubrick would have made phenomenal films no matter what. I don't think he would have been able to do what he did had he not been alive and making films at that time period, because he got at the time astronomical budgets to apply his craft. You wouldn't get that these days to make experimental art house cinema, you know?
For sure. For sure. And art house is, I see art house as a complimentary term.
I 100% mean it's a complimentary term. Yeah,
totally. That was when there were art house hits, for sure.
Oh yeah. Everything was art. I mean, Clue is like art house, but it's like, you know, a thriller. I mean, but, and it's also, it's not all, you know, I think when people talk about the 70s, they talk about the experimentation, and sure, but like All the President's Men is a very serious, straightforward movie. There's not a, I mean, there's not a lot of score, but I don't think any of that's experimentation. It's just a brilliantly made, brilliantly shot by Willis film.
Absolutely.
So there's a lot of like, and Clue is like a mature film. There was like a maturity to those films as well. It wasn't all like, you know, just being in a sandbox and messing around, which that's great too, you know, but it was definitely some like very serious, and I mean that in a laudatory fashion.
Well, you want to move on to a film that's underrated? Or you got another, I did hint that
did
three
I,
was.
Did I give three?
You gave three.
I have to break it just because I said I was going to break it. I'll do M. Fritz Lang's M, 1930. He made it 4 or 5 years after Metropolis, and it's just a another like dirty, grimy film that I think was way ahead of its time, and it's like fucked up in the best way possible, and God damn if I'm not going to spend the rest of my life trying to make anything remotely close to that.
And it's my not at all humble brag will be that I saw that in the theater.
Yeah, nice.
When I was in high school in the 80s. So my friends and I, who I saw it with, will still quote Peter Lorre.
Yeah.
You know, although we are quoting the subtitles we read, but I can picture him saying it, even though I know it was in German. But
yeah,
but amazing film and not dated
amazing
in any way, as current
as well
today as it was then.
100%. I, you know, it's another film I rewatch like maybe once a year, maybe a little less. But the last time I rewatched it, I was just like, seriously,
it's remarkable.
What? How?
Oh my God! My best friend always does that little voice and goes, "Elsie Beckman."
Yeah,
it's so dark.
Yeah,
dark.
It's a dark, dark film, and it's like dirty.
And people
it's
think
funny
that yeah, it's amazing to watch. People, everyone should watch Fritz Lang's M, because people walk around thinking that problems we have in our society are new and current to our society, and these problems have been with humanity forever.
That's one of the reasons why I love, you know, not to go on too long a tangent, but like older movies, you know, show that we're not that far removed. Like, I'm obsessed with history, and I always, one of the obsessions I have with history is what we were just talking about, like mystery. It all feels so far removed, and like, I just want to like walk the street for one day in the 70s and see what that was like, and in the 40s and blah blah. And it's like, you watch these movies and you realize, like, yeah, of course there were pretty, you know, glaring differences, but there's a lot more connection that we have to 100 years ago than we may think.
Yeah, we don't realize. All right, cool. You went over four, three. So now you can let me know you're underrated.
Underrated. It's also hard to, there's so many underrated. I'll start by saying I think Sidney Lumet, who we were just talking about, is an underrated filmmaker. Obviously, his films are not, but I think his name should be in the lexicon as much as Coppola or Scorsese, and I mean that in terms of, like, you know, maybe cinephiles out there, we know his name, but, you know, I always say, like, my mom loves movies, but, like, our collective moms, like, they're not mostly not, like, you know what I mean? And so my, you know, I want the civilians to know his name, you know, the non-cinephiles.
Well, yeah, and I would even say he's better than some of those household names you named, because I think he falls into the category of, he's such a brilliant filmmaker, but he didn't have a signature style every time.
Yeah, sure.
So he did what was right to the material every time and made an amazing film pretty much every time.
Right.
But, you know, Coppola hit us over and over again with the same heavy-handedness, so everyone thinks he's an auteur genius. But Lumet was, you know, I don't know. I heard the same argument out of Steven Soderbergh, I think, last year, where he said, oh, no, I'd make more money if I did the same kind of style over and over. But I do a different style every time. And so, you know, you don't look at a film and think it's mine. You don't know it's me without seeing my name on it.
I think he's so important. I mean, especially someone like Soderbergh, who's, you know, showing everyone that they can do all these different mediums and use different equipment and what you have in your pocket. I think it's so important what he's doing. So, yeah, I agree.
And he'll do something super slick like Ocean's 11, which is still a great film. And then he'll do something where he shoots on an iPhone. Yeah, he'll do it all. Yeah,
but I'm a huge fan. But in terms of Lumet, if you have Dog Day Afternoon and Serpico and 12 Angry Men and you have Network, I mean, you should be in the pantheon. He is in the pantheon of cinema history, but you should be a household name to people who aren't just, you know, engrossed in movies on a daily basis. And speaking of Coppola, you know, Come and See, I think, is an underrated film. Coppola made one of the greatest movies of all time in terms of Apocalypse Now. I agree with that. I think Come and See is an underrated movie that should be also in the lexicon, and that should be, you know, up there with, it's a Soviet 1985 film that's just one of the most horrifying movie. I mean, it's not like Solo horrifying, it's a different type of horrifying. I mean, Solo's in its own realm, but like films like Aino Corrida or stuff like that, but it's a horrifying movie and a brilliant film, and it'll affect you for the rest of your life if you let it. So Come and See, I think, should be up there with, that's another underrated film.
All right. Well, have some fun with a film that's overrated.
Yeah.
And because you're naturally a nice guy, I pick up a vibe. So I'm just going to give the disclaimer that it's not saying bad film.
Yeah.
You could even be a big fan of this film. You could love it. You're just saying
it's not going to be a specific film.
The accolades or the Oscars, you know, maybe it's even, you know, for me, sometimes it's, you know, if there's a director I love and my favorite film of theirs is the one that didn't get any acknowledgement, or the opposite, actually. It's like,
it got too much acknowledgement.
Yeah. Like for me, like Coen Brothers, I love, but I think, I don't know why the world thought Fargo is better than the rest of their films.
I think Fargo's pretty good.
It's good.
I think they've made a lot of good ones.
But I love other stuff even more. And I'm like, I would call Fargo overrated that it got them awards that they didn't get for the other. But anyway, that's my example of saying you're not being an asshole and saying something sucks.
I can appreciate that. I still don't have, I remember when I read this question on your list, no specific film necessarily comes to mind as necessarily overrated. Larger things come to mind. Like, I don't necessarily run out of my house to see every horror film. I'm not like a I'm so sorry. I'm not a massive horror guy. It doesn't mean I don't think there are brilliant horror films, and I love many horror films. It's just like I know people who are like that's their thing, and you know I think they're masochists of the ilk who love like terrifying roller coasters. You know, it's like they love the jump scares. They love all that kind of stuff. Whatever it is, I don't rush them out to see those. Without wanting to incur the ire of any other group specifically, I also don't rush out of my house to see superhero movies. I'm so sorry. I've seen enough. I've seen many of them, and I've seen some really good ones and ones that have made me laugh and ones that have been... I mean, I went to see the Batman at the Egyptian Theater, and I hadn't been to the Egyptian Theater since I was a kid, you know, in the actual like big Egyptian theater. And I remember like rushing up, I was like late, even though I left early. Like I like to see movies during the day and alone. And I like rush up and I go to the thing and like, I don't have time to get popcorn, but I'm like, hey, how do I get to this seat? And he's like, oh, you go through there. And I'm like, through where? And he's like, that curtain. And because I was like, where's the door? I didn't realize you walk through the curtain and it's a stadium entrance. This is like Gladiator, you know what I mean? And so just seeing that movie in that theater, looking around at all the like, you know, beautiful stuff on the walls and the history there. And like that was a fun experience. Like that was a good 3 hours. I was like, this movie can go on for 3 more hours. Like this is fun. So that was good. I think, you know, we were talking about Taika Waititi before. I think he's a genius. I love what he does. I've only seen the last one. I saw it the other day, the Thor Love and Thunder. I thought that was very funny. I think he's really great.
It's on my... I don't go to the movies much because I'm watching so many for the festival, but when a new Taika Waititi film comes out, I'm like, okay, I gotta see that on IMAX. I gotta see it on IMAX.
Yeah, I saw it for him. I saw it... I didn't see it on IMAX. I should have.
Because I read it was shot for IMAX, so... Like, there's a difference between, like, adapted to it and shot for it.
I didn't know that. I try to see everything that's meant to be in IMAX and IMAX, because Tess and I saw Nope day before, or yesterday.
I just heard Nope, you have to see IMAX.
You've got to see IMAX. I mean, the last time was, before that, was Everything Everywhere All at Once. And so those two films, I mean, for different reasons, you know, Everything Everywhere All at Once is mostly, like, contained in this... specific locations, but it's like so crazy and big and it's like so much fun. And then Nope, for the, you know, Hoyte van Hoytema is an absolute genius, and the massive fucking mountains and sprawling vistas, like, come on, man. And I like sitting like not up front where I'm breaking my neck, but like not dead center, you know, so you're looking up at the screen a little bit and you literally can't see anything else.
Yeah, your peripheral is, you're immersed.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So you're there. And so that's how I felt seeing Nope. It was great.
Very cool. All right, well, question 4 is a lesser-known film that people should seek out. I mean, you kind of covered it with the 70s canon, the canon of 70s films, but feel free to name one.
I think there's, it's hard to do because it's like, you know, who am I talking to necessarily? I think anything I'd say, there are cinephiles who would be like, yeah, duh, dude. But I think Anna Christie's one that I haven't talked to a ton of people who've seen that. It's, I think, 1930 as well. It's in the 30s. I think it might be 1930. But it's Greta Garbo's first speaking role. And it's adorable because, maybe adorable is the wrong word, but it's like so funny that she was one of the few actors or actresses to come from the silent era and make it into talkies. And so she was quite famous for a while prior to that, but no one had ever heard her voice. So no one knew that she had an accent. So her first line, it's based off a play, and her first line as she slinks up to the cafe is, "Give me a whiskey." And like no one knew. People were like, "What the fuck?" You know what I mean? From what I've read, I was not alive in 1930. But so from what I've, and I think that story's adorable. I love that.
That's a fascinating story. That, yeah, what an amazing era to live in.
I'm pretty obsessed.
Where there were people, millions of fans worldwide, fans of these movie stars whose voice they never heard.
I had no idea. And I still think it's fascinating. I'm excited for Babylon, the Damien Chazelle film is coming out, because I think it talks about this era where I've always found it fascinating that it was so difficult for these stars to transition, you know, because it's like, you already have that sort of built-in audience. You already have the love of so many people. And then it was just, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of reasons that, you know, I'm not aware of, but I'm excited for that. And then, I mean, newer films that I think people should seek out. I saw Great Freedom finally the other day, and holy fuck, is that not one of the best films I've seen in a really long time. I think Franz Rogowski is one of the greatest actors out there, and that film is like astounding. Everyone should get Mubi. It's on Mubi right now, and see Great Freedom. Turn everything else off, close the windows, put up Duvetine over your windows, and watch that movie.
And put your stuff your phone between the cushions.
Oh yeah,
yeah, yeah.
No, I mean during the pandemic, I when we were in lockdown, I missed theaters so much that I got like, you know, the biggest screen I could afford, and I even at movie theaters where the seats recline, I like to like sit up because I'm that douchebag, and I like at home I you know, I sit up straight, I have, you know, the two pillows like on either arm, so it's like an armrest in the middle of the couch. Has to feel, yeah. Upstream Color is Shane Carruth, that's a great one. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily call that avant-garde because it is like a narrative that's not entirely linear, but like, that's a really fun one because I haven't seen it in a long time, but when it came out and I saw it, I remember being obsessed with it. And, you know, a lot of people were obsessed with this prior film Primer, which is amazing as well, but, and made for like next to nothing. But, this film's great because I think, you know, if you get it on round one, good for you. But like every time I saw it after, I realized, oh, this is more of a narrative than I'd given it credit for. You know what I mean? I didn't realize that it was like all these hidden messages were like right there if you just give it the time that it needs.
Yeah, I'm a fan, and it does amaze me when someone like he can do that thing where every time you watch it, you see more.
Oh yeah. Like every time. Same like, with Primer. You know what I mean?
Oh, Primers.
Yeah. And one of the few who scores his films, and his scores are really good. Like, you know, if you're, when you're done with this podcast, go listen to a score from Shane Carruth. Go listen to the score from...
Look, I don't understand why he's not a household name, but...
I think he made one after that, if I'm not mistaken, and then...
But he never left Texas, right? Isn't he one of those people that wanted to stay...
I feel like I read that.
Stay home?
I feel like I read that. Or like Terrence Malick.
Yeah, and Robert Rodriguez, like...
Yeah.
Dudes are like, I'm not going to move out to LA and try to get big. That kind of thing.
Which is great. Which is great. I mean, the fact that Terrence Malick has never done an interview. I remember when I was younger, Terrence Malick was this insanely mysterious figure. And there was one photo of him, you know, it was like Thomas Pynchon. And then he like was like, I'm, you know, going to go make a bunch of movies. Thankfully he did because he's a genius. And now then we saw him at like music festivals shooting his movie. And it's like, wait a second. Now we have, you know, an exorbitant amount of photos of this guy. But prior, we only had one to go off of. He was like such a mystery. And he still is. I mean, still is a mystery. I don't think he's ever done an interview.
Still is for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll wrap this thing up because
I think I've given you enough.
Yeah. The four questions episodes are also like a fun little tight thing for people to go
except
through.
Except when Rob comes to the guest bedroom.
No. I think a half hour is pretty standard.
Okay.
I think half hour, you know, because especially the back and forth, I mean, about
you put
films,
a mic in front of me. I'm going to talk, man.
You know? All right. Well, I hope you all enjoyed that. That was Rob Campoy, filmmaker who made A Face on the Ceiling, which is in the Discovery Indie Film TV series, season 6. Yes, it is. Man, I think season 6 just locked up last night. I got the last film. I think we just hit 300 minutes for the 10 episodes.
10 episodes.
Although there's going to be like an episode or two are going to be like a 40-minute film of all things.
Okay.
So there might be some shorter episodes. But yeah, I think we're locked up, so... I don't quite have, if only I could say what episode it's in, but it very well may be, you know.
I guess that means you're going to have to watch the whole thing.
I like to, they do have to watch the whole thing.
I guess that's what that means.
All right. And if you want to watch it, just go to Amazon Prime Video, search for Discover Indie Film and enjoy. I guess I didn't say this in the last one. Oh, and so I won't. Now I was going to say the thing about how we used to be free and clear with the Prime, and then they did the Indie Purge, and they make us charge 99 cents an episode or $7.99 for a season. But guess what, dear listener? We're talking about 20 to 25 independently produced passion project films in 10 episodes. So you're paying $8 to support like 25 people, just support their efforts. You know, it's not a big ask. It's not the biggest ask. Less than half the price of a movie ticket.
And I've seen some of the films and they're pretty amazing. Pretty fucking great.
They are. It's going to be good. It's going to be good. So that is my pitch. Like and subscribe to the podcast. Give the TV series 5 stars. Give 5 stars to anything you see the name Rob Campoy associated with. If you want to learn more about this podcast and the TV series that was born out of it, you just go to discoverindiefilm.com. And on social media, it's at DIFWins. I think at the top I mentioned the award you got at Sherman Oaks Film Festival. Sherman Oaks Film Festival we hold every November here in L.A. Nice little neighborhood of L.A. And you can learn about that at ShermanOaksFF.com. And it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. And finally, Film Invasion Los Angeles is the sister festival to Sherman Oaks. That's every June. And you can learn about it at FilmInvasionLA.com. And it's at FilmInvasionLA on social media. And we went long, so I'm not even going to mention THC Cinema. But if you want, just Google it.
My fault. I'm sorry.
No. I'm still torn about whether or not I should mention it. But it's about a perfectly legal substance. But there.
Yeah, totally. Come on.
Rob, thanks for coming over.
Jeff, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for doing it in person instead of Zooming.
Oh, man. I'm so glad I got to get more inspiration for the guest bedroom.
You know, you can see the gorilla and the wolf. All right, so
for a second, animals, I thought that was real.
Stuffed animals
for a
around.
Second, I was like, is that a raccoon over there?
All right, well, thanks, Rob. And thank you, everyone who's listening.